From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made when a woman jumped on Instagram to post about her wellness routine. She wrote about what a productive day looks like. It included nearly 8 hours of parts of the following: meditation, going for a run, taking a nap, going out for healthy meals, and other forms of so-called self-care. The Instagram post received enough praise to fill a truck full of activated charcoal. But is it realistic? Does the average person have 8 hours each day to self-care, to focus on wellness, to take charge of their life? Probably not. When we talk about wellness, it can mean a lot of different things. Broadly speaking, we're talking about an industry that focuses on diet, supposed nutritional supplements, mental health. It's an industry that makes about $30 billion each year, according to the New York Times. But a raft of studies shows that many wellness products do not stand up to actual testing. Writing for the New York Times, Dr. Jen Gunter published a piece titled "Worshipping the False Idols of Wellness." Dr. Gunter writes, quote, "Modern medicine wants you to get your micronutrients from your diet, which is inarguably the most natural source. But the wellness industrial complex has managed to pervert that narrative and make supplements a necessary tool for nonsensical practices, such as boosting the immune system or fighting the war on inflammation. The resulting fluorescent yellow urine from multivitamins may provide a false sense of efficacy, but it's a fool's gold and the consequence of excessive B2 that couldn't possibly be absorbed. Many people, women especially, have long been marginalized and dismissed by medicine, but the answer does not lie in predatory conspiracy theories, a faux religion, or expensive magical products. In its current form, wellness isn't filling in the gaps left by medicine. It's exploiting them." End quote. Harsh stuff. So this hour, we offer a conversation about wellness, where it can be effective, where it can be exploitative, what we ought to expect for our mental health, for our physical health, for our diet, nutrition, supplements, and more. Lots to talk about this hour. And to blame for this conversation is Nicole Vandenberg, who is an experienced registered yoga instructor, recently had a little bit to say on social media. So thank you for that. It's nice to see you here.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
And I'm not fully blaming you. I actually flagged Dr. Jen Gunter's piece a while back because I thought that was interesting. So it's not just Nicole's fault, but we'll have a good conversation with her, with Jill Chodak, who is a clinical dietitian with the Center for Community Health and Prevention at the University of Rochester Medical Center. Nice to see you here in studio.
Thanks for having me.
And also with us is Lou Guadagnino, who's co-founder of Living Stress-Free, Inc. Nice to see you back here in studio. How are you?
I'm doing wonderful, and thank you for having me back.
And for 31 years, you did what?
31 years, I worked in mental health and addiction fields.
So I want to kind of start with this question. Just when we talk about the word wellness, it is an industrial complex in this country now. But I want to ask all of you what it means to you. So, Nicole, I'll start with you. And here, wellness, what does it sort of mean to you?
I like to think of wellness as an all-encapsulating term to include dietary health, physical health, and mental health. I think all parts need to be valued equally for a person to be fully well.
Okay. And is the word wellness right now for you, is that something that brings a negative or a positive connotation to mind?
There is a bit of a negative connotation in today's world because, as you said, how wellness has become such an industry and such a profitable industry, there is a little bit of a negative connotation for me when I hear that term.
We'll go down a little bit more of the specific road with her in just a moment. Jill Chodak, you hear wellness, you think what?
Similar to what Nicole said. So I think mind-body health. I also think kind of whole lifestyle health. And so just, it does have a little bit of a negative connotation to me as well. I also kind of focus in on what I do with individual wellness. So I think we like to have this broad, overarching, homogenous description of wellness. And I think it should be different for each individual.
Okay. Lou, how about you when you hear wellness?
Well, for me, wellness is, I'm an old timer here. So wellness came from holistic medicine. Long time ago, back in the 1970s, I believe is when it started. And it then became wellness as time went on, because I think the name was too granola for most people, holistic medicine. But it was never, as far as I know, it was never originally. It was something that came from Eastern disciplines that were coming to the United States, such as yoga and meditation, Tai Chi, and other disciplines. And later on, it started stretching the definition, and it became kind of a brand. And so now I think it has become diluted. But for me, no, I don't have any bad connotations about it.
Okay. Well, Nicole, it was a couple weeks ago that you unceremoniously retired, I think, as a yoga instructor, maybe unofficially. What was going on and what sparked that?
The decision to retire from teaching was a bit personal, but I have experienced over my 6+ years working in, quote unquote, the fitness industry, just some feelings of negativity around how people in the industry tend to paint why we engage in physical activity. One of the biggest things I see is people treating physical activity as a way of punishing themselves for what they eat, if they eat something bad, quote unquote, or solely as a way of making themselves look good. Whereas for me, especially as a registered yoga teacher, and I think this is something that in the yoga industry tends to be a little bit more going the other way, physical activity should be something that people engage in to feel good physically, not just to make themselves look good. And I feel that in the fitness industry especially, we've really gone the other way on that, that it's really become about how do I look, or I ate something bad, so I need to punish myself.
And they would literally tell you that.
They would not literally tell me that. This is really something that I've
seen. I bet you they literally tell Jill Chodak that. We'll get to that in a second.
That's true.
But go ahead.
This is something that I've seen more within the community. You know, as an instructor, you connect with the people that are coming through your classes. You follow them on social media. And then you just start to see the comments that they make about themselves. So I don't know if it's necessarily that something that people are being told outright by their instructors, but certainly maybe something people are being told subconsciously from food companies, fitness companies, big companies like Lululemon, I know has come under fire for not being inclusive in their sizing, for example. So maybe it's not something people are being told outright in the industry, but certainly something people are being told subconsciously.
I think more what I'm wondering is if people would literally come to your class and say to you, like, I'm here because I want to look good, or I'm here because, you know, sometimes people like to joke that I run to eat, you know, for those kinds of things. And what you might say if you're teaching a yoga class in your past life to someone who said, okay, Nicole, well, I'm here because, you know, I want to look hot, you know, as opposed to how do I want to feel? What do you say to that?
That is absolutely something that I'd experienced. You know, people, I always say, come to yoga for, quote unquote, the Madonna arms. That's something, you know, the Michelle Obama arms. They come to yoga because they want those arms and to be jacked. And for myself as a teacher, I can respect that that's what led them to the practice, but especially the practice of yoga, which has mindfulness tied to it. I would like to tell them that that might be what led you here, but I hope that you can get something more out of this that might help you on the road to accepting how you look and loving yourself for how you are, rather than being so dead set on changing it.
And do you think the wellness industry, to the sense that there is sort of an industrial complex, as Dr. Jen Gunter said, has sort of co-opted some of this to commodify it?
Without a doubt.
Money drives some of these. I know that's a new concept that a lot of listeners are like, money, really money. But also on the subject of the way people are then internalizing it. And you also mentioned that you saw, you know, the Instagram posts that I was kind of cheekily referring to off the top. But these are real things that people are talking about, these, you know, my wellness routine and 8 hours a day of naps and self-care and whatnot, which I want to respect. I mean, I certainly don't want to diss anybody's idea of self-care. But for you, it seemed to feel like a little over the top, it seemed.
I mean, you see these influencers on social media, on Instagram, and they've been able to dedicate, you know, their entire lives to painting that picture of, you know, I spend 8 hours a day making my smoothie bowls and doing my meditation and going for a run. And for someone who might be like a mom of four who works full time, or, you know, a dad who works the night shift, those ideals aren't realistic. So I think that we in the wellness industry have a responsibility to help people feel empowered to engage in self-care, engage in fitness, physical activity, and healthy dietary practices and mindfulness practices, and not feel defeated because they can't spend 8 hours a day doing it. To feel like there is a way for it to be accessible for them, because to be honest, those are the people that really need it. It's not the people who have 8 hours a day to spend on Instagram. Not that they don't need it, but the people that are overwhelmed, that are burnt out, that are working to support a family, they need wellness practices just as much as those people. And they need a way for it to be accessible for them.
And before I turn to the other guests, does wellness, whether it's in what you've seen in the nutritional side, the workout side, the mental health side, are there overpromises that if you just do this, you know, you can turn your health around, you can turn your mind around? Yeah?
Absolutely. I mean, there's no magic pill. It's not the Matrix. You know, you take the red pill and, you know, your eyes are open, or you take the blue pill and you live a happy, carefree life. It's work. And that's something that we like to say in the yoga industry is do the work. But if you don't do the work, you're not going to get the results. And I think there is a lot of overpromising. There's, you know, if you just download the Headspace app, you're going to be okay. Or if you just follow a keto diet, I'm making jokes.
Oh, gosh.
While I scream. If you just follow the keto diet, you know, you'll lose weight. There's all kinds of quick fixes and magic pills being promised. And I firmly believe that none of those work. It's personal, and it takes work.
I know that Jill and Lou are going to want to follow up on the work as opposed to the quick fix side of this. Listeners, if you want to share your stories about what works for you, your thoughts on wellness, do you think there's overpromises? Are there certain things that are working for you? 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free. 844-295-8255. 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester. 263-9994. You can email the program connections@WXXI.org. Did you have an activated charcoal smoothie this morning?
I did not.
You did not. So on the side of overpromising versus what's realistic in terms of what we eat, if wellness has any negative connotation, why does it rub you the wrong way as a registered dietitian?
Okay, that's a great question. I think it's because of, back to kind of what Nicole was just saying, is we have a group of people, I mean, nationwide, who are struggling with obesity, with diabetes, with all these things, and I find that they're under-supported. So they're going toward things that they think will help them or things that they think will make them feel better or solve their problems, and they get roped into gimmicks or things that could actually hurt them, or they're not getting the support that they need. And so that's kind of why it rubs me the wrong way, is because I've dedicated my life to learning the things that I need to know to help folks deal with not only their health problems, but to rope mental health in there. And so I would hate to see them feel under-supported and go in a direction that could hurt them, when there should be medicinal support or dietitians or people out there who could really help them with their whole health as opposed to just their weight or things like that. And so really, as a dietitian, that's kind of how I try to define my practice, is I don't want to sacrifice someone's mental health just for physical health. It has to be both. And I think we've gotten away from that as a culture and as a society. And I think it's partially because people are feeling like they now are aware of their problems and they want to solve them, but they don't know where to turn.
Well, and if someone sees that a pill is going to change something, or a supplement is going to change something, there's a number of interesting questions surrounding this. Some of the pushback Dr. Jen Gunter got to her piece was, well, what's the harm, even if it's placebo? I'm going to get to that in just a second. But I've known Jill for many years, and now seeing you work as a registered dietitian, I think you're made for this job, because what you are describing is the connection of not just nutrition, not just eating, but mental health. And too often we siloed those things.
Yes.
And you talk to patients all the time who, if you crash off a diet, a keto diet or something, it's not just that it didn't work for you, but it could be tied to depression. It could be tied to all these other things that could be triggered by it.
Well, and also it's like, so, and I'm not hating on the keto diet. I know I'll probably get some tweets or emails about this. I try to spread kindness, because we need more of that in this wellness culture that we're trying to create, and in medicine and whatever. So when I talk about keto, I'm talking about it in a sense from a clinical perspective that, okay, someone who blindly tries keto, who's never had a lipid panel to see what their triglycerides are or their LDL is or whatever, if they try it and they increase their fats and their protein and they decrease their fiber, they could really hurt themselves. Their triglycerides could increase and they could get pancreatitis. Like, these are major clinical things that could happen just because a person felt like they were pushed to weight loss and they wanted it quick and they didn't have support otherwise. And so really, that's why I go back to my original comment when we first started, is individual care and individual wellness is so important because we all are dealing with all different things. So your example of the mom of four, I might see a mom of four come in and she thinks she needs to lose weight and she wants to do, you know, a fast or this or that.
A cleanse.
Yeah. And maybe the whole reason that she was gaining weight was because she wasn't finding time to eat for herself because she was dealing with her four kids or because she wasn't getting enough sleep. So there are so many players in this game that I think I know I can speak for myself. I just want to support the whole person, their whole like life scenario, and that means more than wellness to me.
Okay. Lou Guadagnino, when it comes to that question of quick fix versus the work that has to be done, what's your approach with living stress-free on that?
Well, first of all, can I just say something about yoga, and then that will lead into this?
Sure.
Yoga, I get very passionate, so forgive my affect about this. Yoga has been ruined in the United States as far as I'm concerned. It's been destroyed. It is a spiritual practice that comes from India that's thousands of years old. In India, when you go to a teacher and you learn yoga, the teacher gives you one or two asanas or postures to practice, sometimes for years, until you're ready to get back to maybe a third posture. The point of yoga is unity. That's what the word means, unity. And the expression of unity is the experience of love, love for yourself and love for other people. That's the point of yoga. It's not to fit into yoga pants. That's something we did to yoga. That's not, you know, if you went to India right now, people would be appalled at what we're calling yoga, and they should be. So part of it is not really yoga. It's what we've done to yoga. So, yes, everything we teach at LSF, like we don't teach yoga anymore. We have
the American version of yoga.
Is in America. Yes. The
problem is. It's like saying Italian food.
Yes.
The
Italian food in Rochester is not Italian food. It's American food.
Yeah, yeah.
But at any rate, what we teach is everything is a transition from a spiritual practice. Our meditation that we teach, everything that we do is a practice. And we tell people to be very patient with themselves. This is going to take a long time. We give them support. We definitely do everything we can to make sure that people are not criticizing themselves or punishing themselves. And we also make sure that we don't give false promises. If somebody comes to me, I teach people all the time how to practice meditation. I've been doing it since I was a teenager. And when I teach people meditation, I always tell them, this is going to take about a year before you really start seeing any benefits. So you should really think about that before you sign up. So I think that really people need to understand that these are disciplines, and like any discipline, it's not going to happen overnight.
All right, so Lou, here's the hardest question of the hour. Are you ready for this?
The hardest?
I mean, the name of the business is Living Stress-Free. There is no life without stress, I don't think.
Right. No, there's no life without stress.
So is that an overpromise?
That's our label. We're a company. We, you know, we have a flashy name. We have to have a flashy name. It's that simple. We have never said to anybody that you will not experience stress. What we've said to people is that there's basically three types of stress. That's what we teach. There's transient stress, which is, you know, the pot is boiling over the teapot and you stop it and stress is gone. Okay. Second is residual. You're in a bad situation. Maybe your job is hard for you. Stress builds up. That takes a lot longer to be able to expel. And then there's what we call accumulated stress, which is basically traumatic events that people have, which alter the course of their life. And that takes a very long time, if it's even possible, to get all that stress out of the person. But that's our model. That's how we work.
I mean, oddly enough, I'm connecting what Lou just said to what Nicole said about influencers, and I'm thinking of the Fyre Festival of all things. When you have influencers who want to present this idea of what life is, this idea of this, I'm on an island, I'm a carefree life, I'm practicing self-care on my, you know, third mojito of this afternoon with my toes in the sand, come to this festival, which isn't even a thing. You know, influencers creating this image of a stress-free life versus the work of a stress are hugely different things. And yet somehow the wellness industry got to include influencers projecting this, which probably drives you up the wall, I would think.
It drives me up the wall because the saddest part to me is not just that people buy into this and it's not true. But what's really sad is that meditation and yoga and many different spiritual techniques, mostly from Asia, are extremely helpful. I worked in a hospital for over 30 years. It doesn't need to be a battle. Okay, we can do both, but we have to do both responsibly. So, for instance, if someone comes to me and I see that their anxiety is a true anxiety disorder, I tell them to either see my wife, who's a therapist, or see somebody else, perhaps for medication. You know, in other words, what we do is not to treat medical or mental health symptoms. We don't do that. We work with people who those are already managed and they want to take the next step in their life.
See, this is a really important distinction for anybody hearing this going, well, okay, but I like American yoga. What's the harm? Or I like these supplements. And you know what? I think they're making me feel better. Maybe they are. Here's what Dr. Gunder wrote in the New York Times. Quote, what's the harm of spending money on, for example, charcoal for non-existent toxins or vitamins for expensive urine or grounding bed sheets to better connect you with the Earth's electrons? Here's what. The placebo effect or trying something natural can lead people with serious illness to postpone effective medical care. Every doctor I know has more than one story about a patient who died because they chose to try to alkalinize their blood or gambled on intravenous vitamins instead of getting cancer care. Data is emerging that cancer patients who opt for alternative medical practices only, many promoted by companies that sell products of questionable value, are more likely to die, end quote. So there, it's not just, well, the placebo might help you, because I'm down with placebo. Placebo can be cool. You want to add to some of that, Jill?
Yeah, I would say that I've seen many patients who come into me and who end up having hypervitaminosis, where they've oversupplemented themselves on vitamin D. Because if you think about supplements, they're not regulated by the FDA currently. So you can go to a store and buy 10,000 IUs of vitamin D, and it says to take one a day. And the upper tolerable limit for supplementation for vitamin D is 4,000 IUs. So do the math. And vitamin D is stored in our body, and so it stays with you, and it actually can start to have really toxic effects on your body, calcify your organs, do all these things, lead to fatigue. I mean, and this is just one vitamin that I'm talking about. There are many that can do this. B12 is the rage now for energy. We supplement B12. Well, you can create a secondary folate deficiency because of this. And so all of these other things, there's a lot that we don't know about our body and how it metabolizes things, and I recognize that. And so just being mindful that you need to get the support from people who are educated on this before you make those choices, I think, is important. And having someone who supports your care is of the utmost.
Nicole, do you want to respond to some of what you heard about the yoga industry? How do you feel about what you heard from Lou there?
I don't entirely disagree with his comment that, you know, America has ruined yoga. It may be a little more nuanced than that, but I don't entirely disagree. I think I agree with the central point of that. I am trained in the Baptiste Power Vinyasa style of yoga. So Perhaps in your mind, I'm a contributor to it's a very fast-paced athletic style of yoga. So perhaps I'm a contributor to people flocking to yoga as a form of physical fitness. Kind of like I said earlier, I think that we as yoga instructors have a responsibility to make sure that when people come to the practice because they want to look sexy, that we are providing them with the lineage and putting spirituality into our teaching so that they receive some of the benefits of the spiritual and mindful roots of the practice. And that is one of the things that I loved about being a yoga teacher I took very seriously is that whether my class included a bunch of push-ups and handstands, always making it a point to make sure that people were engaging in, you know, breath work and mindfulness while they're doing their sun salutations or whatever it is that they were doing. And go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, my observation of that is, let's use the Italian food analogy, was when you talk to, I've talked to people who I will not name and out them versus someone like Lydia Bastianich, who writes books on Italian-American cooking, but she says there's a difference between Americans being lazy, being like spaghetti and meatballs, that's what everyone in Italy eats, like not really, that's not just like Italian food, versus someone who's Italian coming to the United States and naturally taking everything that you can find in your food culture, finding as much as that here, fusing that to what is here, and creating something new that retains roots of the old. Yoga in this country can retain roots of it and evolve, as I would think, in the way that is respectful, that isn't just about, as you say, looking hot or, you know, doing this so you can eat bad foods, which I'm sure Jill wants to define what a bad food is or whether it exists or not. Versus something much more crass. I think that's the crass kind of yoga. I think what Nicole is talking about is much more of a fusion. At least that's how I am hearing it, Lou. What do you think?
But yeah, please, Nicole, don't think that I'm saying anything. No, I think it's fine if people practice yoga for exercise, okay? And that's perfectly fine, obvious. That's their choice. But it's also helpful to let people know all of the benefits you can receive from yoga. Like, a lot of people don't recognize that yoga is not just hatha yoga, which is physical yoga. There's bhakti yoga, which is devotional yoga. There's what they call seva, which is selfless service for people who are big workers. So there's a lot of different forms of yoga. And I think that what we need to do is, and that's what Living Stress-Free does, we're trying to culturally transition these practices to keep the roots, at the same time, to be innovative enough to make them usable for people.
You want to add to that?
I was going to say, to be clear, I do think there are organizations or places where people are just pushing the physical and leaving the mindfulness aspect out of it, which is sad. I will say, for 6 years, the majority of my career as a yoga teacher, I taught at Breathe. And one of the things that Breathe has done recently, which I really respect and like, is that they've implemented a meditation-only program. So you have a lot of people that come to Breathe because they want the power of vinyasa yoga. They want to sweat. It's hot yoga. So, you know, people have this impression that if they're sweating, that they're burning more calories or they're releasing toxins or, you know, whatever. There's science to back up that could be true, could not be true. I'm not the expert on that. But they come to it for that, the hot yoga, the sweat, the movement. And now Breathe has implemented this meditation program where you can tack on a 15-minute meditation before or after your practice. And I think that that is so crucial and important that these people are coming for the physical fitness, but they're really trying to push sitting, being silent, and meditating. And I love that they've incorporated that because they have such a huge, you know, grasp on the yoga community here in Rochester. I think there's a responsibility that they had to do that. And I like that they've done that.
Did they check Twitter during those 15 minutes? No?
They might be.
I guess not.
Probably not Twitter.
Rich in Rochester, first on the phone. Go ahead, Rich.
Hey, how are you doing today, Evan?
Very good, sir. I'm doing well.
There's several things that I'm hearing. Like, when I started hearing words like toxin and spirituality and stuff like that, I'm very cynical when I start hearing those words because, and then throwing the word science, like she just did in one phrase, she said, you know, releasing the toxin and the science behind it. You don't hear that in scientific language and in scientific studies as much as you hear in the wellness industry. Also, one of your guests mentioned residual stress. What does he mean by that? Is he talking about the event or the situation that caused your stress or the stress itself? Because if you're talking about residual stress as the stress itself, it almost sounds like cleansing toxins out of the body or stuff. And I become very jaded. I listen very closely to the language that anybody from the wellness industry uses. And for me, it goes a lot to the credibility of what I'm hearing. And I just want your guests to comment on things like those terms like toxins and stuff like that, that to me have become almost pejoratives in the wellness industry.
All right, so a couple of things there. So, as always, Rich, thanks for the phone call. Residual stress was you, Lou. You want to talk about residual stress?
Yeah, I'm not certain exactly what his question is about residual stress.
What is it? What do you mean? How does it work?
It's a very simple, it's a terminology that we made up, so it's not something that, you know, you're not going to find anyplace else, but it's very simple. When you go to a job, let's say, or if you're in a marriage or a relationship that doesn't make you happy, it's prolonged stress. So, for instance, somebody who doesn't like their job for 10 years, Okay, that stress is going to build up in their system.
So it may not be acute or you know, deep in a moment, but it's a buildup over time?
It's a buildup over time.
Like plaque on a tooth that's not necessarily a cavity.
Well, let's look at it this way. We all know that trauma usually comes from an event, okay? To answer part of his question, we now know that trauma does not come just from the event, but from the person's perception of the event. That's part of trauma, how the person perceive the event. Mm-hmm. So when it comes to residual stress, what we're saying is the exact same thing. We're saying that this is a traumatic event, but it wasn't one event. It was a prolonged stressful event that went on for years for the person. And it became, in a sense, trauma. It became traumatic in a sense because it went on so long. We know that people do die from heart attacks because they dislike their job so much. That's residual stress.
Okay. Some other thoughts on what he's at? I mean, Jill, when you hear certain terminology, again, some of it scientific, some of it, I think the fringes of the wellness industry have some, I guess the word would be some woo going on. I don't know.
I don't know. I think it's interesting. So toxin is actually kind of like a triggering word. And I think you were actually saying it in a way where you were focusing kind of more away from it rather than...
I was.
Yeah. Okay. So you weren't actually talking about doing yoga for toxins, but rather you were
correct.
Talking... Oh, right. So I just wanted to clarify that. But then from my practice, I am very aware of the words that I use and it's very intentional. And I think that kind of illustrates the point that I was wanting to make is with the individual kind of intentions and motivations is that you want to be mindful of your words. So I might have a person who presents to me saying I need to lose weight because every single practitioner she's seen has told her so. And I honor that intention. I honor that autonomy. I'm not a judgmental practitioner. I will not judge you. You have a safe space. If that's why you think you're coming and that's your intention, cool. We'll honor it. We'll work with it. But most of the time, what happens after we use the time to flesh out thoughts, feelings, stress, dietary recall, you name it, that generally becomes a secondary thing to another intention. I intend to feel well, which can be a trigger word for some people. I intend to stay alive long enough to play with my grandkids. I intend to enjoy cookouts rather than focusing on the things I can't eat. I intend to wake up and not hate myself the second I wake up or measure out every single thing for breakfast. And it's the pause in the moments that I have with these patients who think their intention is weight loss, and then we actually get down deep to support them rather than judge, that makes the difference. And so, yes, words can be triggering, and I'm very mindful of it, and I'm not perfect, but I honor that, and I hope to provide, and I hope others provide a supportive space where we can discuss those words and use science to move forward however that patient chooses autonomously.
We're going to get back to your emails after our only break of the hour. I've got a couple more to read in just a moment here. Producer Megan Mack points out that according to Forbes, as an industry sector, wellness has grown by about 6.4% annually in just the last 4 years. So, I mean, it's big growth year to year and globally now a $4.2 trillion market. So that is the wellness industry represents more than 5% of global economic output based on how you measure it. That's a lot of money. So when you think about commodification, like Nicole Vandenberg mentioned earlier this hour, it's no surprise that people want to jump in there and grab some cash. The question is, what's valid? What's not valid, and what can actually be harmful. And that's what we're talking about when we talk about the wellness industry this hour. Nicole Vandenberg, who is an experienced registered yoga instructor, Lou Guadagnino, co-founder of Living Stress-Free, Inc., Jill Chodak, clinical dietitian with the Center for Community Health and Prevention at the University of Rochester Medical Center. You can email the program connections at wxxi.org. You can call toll-free 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. We're back to your feedback next. I'm Evan Dawson, Thursday on The Next Connections, a conversation with the candidates for Rochester City Court Judge, our second round of interviews in advance of the upcoming primary this coming Tuesday. In our second hour, a preview the Xerox Rochester International Jazz Festival. The Jazz Festival coming back. We'll tell you about the headliners, the shows you must see, what the city's going to be like during Jazz Fest 2019. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. If you're listening during hot yoga, hello. The mobile app, you can hear us just about anywhere on the WXXI mobile app. But wherever you are, we're talking about wellness, and we're talking about the connotations that that industry, which is now a monster industry, the connotations that that industry creates with you and what's valid and what's not. And Willa emails the program and says, Evan, I don't think about good food and bad food, but I do have a small list of problem foods I try to avoid. If I eat them, yes, I'm probably going running the next morning. I don't necessarily see what's wrong with that. That's from Willa. You want to hit the term problem food. She said, not a good food, bad food, problem food. Do you like that term, honestly?
Honestly, so again, coming from a place of support, I don't judge, so I don't see anything wrong with that. There's okay. nothing wrong with that. We see too much of there's something wrong with you. There's something wrong with that. I would say if you're looking for support, it could give, depending on the problems, I mean, this is kind of like a very general comment.
You probably would want to know a lot
I would want to know like what type of problems and stuff. But in general, if it's giving you problems, I'd be mindful about that and really assess how that makes you feel, why you gravitate toward that. A lot of times we put too much weight, pun intended, on food. And so food should be food. It shouldn't provide a kind of like it, she talks about in that one article in the op-ed is it shouldn't hold any moral value. It shouldn't provide like a mental support or reward or punishment. It should just be food. And so if those foods are causing you problems, whether it's physical or mental or both, just explore that and see what's what. And, you know, you might find some answers that help you navigate to a direction that's positive. But it, in summary, there's nothing wrong with that. We're all just a work in progress.
Well, speaking of something wrong with, Monica wants to know, does your panel honestly think there's something wrong with wanting to look hot?
No.
It's from Monica.
No.
No, absolutely not. Okay. I really appreciate it when people do.
Oh, Lou, don't make me regret inviting you. So, but let's get serious for a second. I think because I think I take the point that Monica is making here, but I hear a distinction in what our guests are saying. For example, when Nicole Vandenberg says, if people would come to you when you were working as an experienced registered yoga teacher to say, you know, I'm here to look hot, or I'm here to whatever, have arms or whatever people would say. You know, maybe you would say, okay, that's valid, but like, let's also talk about this other. But there's also this idea that society has a pretty narrow view of that, and we're pretty punishing on people sometimes. And I would be concerned, I would just tell Monica, my observation from listening to the guests is more concerned with this narrow view of whatever hot would look like and the mental health issues it would cause if you don't fit that small box of whatever that is. What do you think?
Absolutely. Again, I don't have a problem with people starting a yoga practice because they want to do it for a workout. That's how I started my yoga practice. I walked into a breeze because I thought I was going to sweat out toxins, which, by the way, I don't think is true, just to just to address that.
Sure.
I do think that we have a very I think it's very clear that we have a very narrow definition of, as Americans, of what hot should look like according to, you know, commercialization, the advertising industry, you know, what have you. What I would hope for any person that begins any form of physical fitness, whether it's yoga or running or whatever, as a way of looking hot, that they eventually that fitness becomes an avenue for them to love their body for what it can do and not what it looks like. That for me was such an important part of my journey as a yogi and a yoga teacher, is that when I started my yoga practice to quote unquote look hot, my practice grew into something where I became inspired by what my body could do physically and the strength that my body had when I treated it well. The way that I felt in the morning physically when I treated my body well, and the effect that that had on my mental health. So, you know, I don't think that there's anything wrong with wanting to look hot. I'm great. I'm really glad that that drives people to yoga and forms of physical fitness, because I fully believe that if people continue to participate in that, they're going to receive some of these residual mental health and self-confidence benefits.
I'm just reading comments from a woman named Tony who says, I thought about how unfair women's sizes are compared to men's sizes. I do not, I know men who don't wear anything that is considered a large. No one makes comments about men's sizes, but women have to shop at plus size stores to find something equivalent. That's from Tony. So, you know, I'm going back to the Lululemon sizing thing, which, I mean, goes back to, you know, what is considered average, what actually is more typical, maybe that's a better term, or yeah, you know, usual, versus what it says to you when you can't even find something on a rack at a store that's, you know,
when you talk about trauma and stress and what that feels like. And so back to the hot point,
yeah.
if that's your intention, if that's, you are consciously choosing that that's what's driving you, cool. Like, but I find that folks who come in with that intention, it's often driven by forces that are not autonomous. So if you are, as an adult, choosing this is what I want to be and I want to be hot and that's great and nothing is pushing you societally to do that, great. And I'll support you no matter what, honestly. Mm-hmm. But just being aware of the external forces that might foster that thought in you is helpful. And then also being mindful of what we were just talking about with the sizing is like that can be really stressful and traumatizing for people when you can't find a size. You want to start being active and changing your life, and now you can't even find a size to do so. And so being aware of that stress, that trauma, and hopefully creating a support network of people who will help you with that.
Before I turn to Lou Guadagnino, I just want to say, to kind of put last point to Monica, I don't know anybody who doesn't want to look attractive. It's just a matter of, you know, are we trying to squeeze into what society has created so narrowly as opposed to just appreciating who we are? That's really a lot of where. And if wellness takes you down a road of thinking that to be your best wellness self, you've got to fit something really, really narrow, I'm not sure that that is anything other than commodification, to go back to that word. And Lou, when it comes to why people come to you, you know, you're the co-founder of Living Stress-Free. Stress comes from a lot of different sources. Is there a more typical reason that people come to you? I mean, is there...
I think what happens, and I'm sure that Nicole and Jill both see this as well, is that people come to me or to my wife and see us because their stress has gotten out of control. And what I mean by that is not necessarily symptoms like really high anxiety, but stress, and this gets back to residual stress, it affects our behavior. So most of the time when people come to me, their behavior has gotten out of control. I'm not talking about criminal behavior or anything, but maybe their relationships are becoming disrupted. Their wife and children are having trouble with them. They're having trouble at work with their relationships. And they don't know what's going on. And they believe they have a lot of problems to solve. And Jill said something about this, I believe, earlier. And I always tell them, you know, let's forget the problems. Let's lower your stress and see if you still have the problems once the stress is down. Because the truth of the matter is when you're feeling good and your stress is down, a lot of times your perception changes completely and you realize, you know, I actually don't have as many problems as I thought. So most people come to me because they're either having problems that they really can't explain, or they want to make their life different than it is, and they have obstacles that stop them. And those obstacles are being caused by stress. It could be low self-esteem. It could be a lot of things.
And I think the self-esteem piece ties into that self-image that we have.
Oh, very much so.
What we allow ourselves to eat, what we think we must look like, you know, to fit those descriptions.
Yeah, that's where the spiritual element of wellness should come in. There should be the element of spirituality, and I don't mean religion, I mean spirituality. If someone starts a yoga class because they want to be hot, that's great. But if 5 years later, they're now 5 years older, I'm sure they've noticed this when they look in the mirror, they're 5 years older. Hopefully, they're learning to realize that, you know, this is a transitory planet. I'm going to keep changing. I'm going to be old no matter what I do. And hopefully, they'll start loving themselves more the way they are.
Let me read a couple of emails. Chris writes to us to say, interesting email here. He says, obstacle course racing and outdoor adventure is my healthy body and mind approach. I just posted today on Facebook that I was reevaluating 6 years because my knees basically have no cartilage left and I was unable to run anymore to do my long distance biking. I got into obstacle course racing and it really got me back into the groove, and I love the culture and the events. Also, the confidence it gave me was amazing. Pushing, pulling, lifting, crawling, and climbing, it was awesome, and it got me fit mentally and physically after a long haul with challenges with lupus. So that's great. I mean, I love hearing stuff like that, that mm-hmm. sparks a sense of adventure. But there's also a great mental health component there, the confidence that comes with that of just getting up and getting out and doing it. So, Chris, I appreciate that. And Stephanie wants to just jump in regarding self-care and says, Evan, I agree that some self-care ideas are unrealistic, but I don't think it should be belittled entirely. Some people need self-care, especially mentally. Okay, I think that's a great point, and we hit that early in the hour. You know, Nicole, when you see someone talking about an 8-hour day of a wellness routine that includes self-care for a nap and then going out for eating healthy food, all these things that sound good in one day and you wonder how many days of the year you could possibly replicate that much time, I think that's a great point. But Stephanie's also saying, let's not belittle the idea of self-care entirely. So where do you find that balance?
I agree. I don't think that we should belittle the idea of self-care entirely. I think everybody needs to participate in some sort of self-care practice. I think two of the issues that I've seen that have come up in the industry are, one, self-care practices that actually just become indulgent. You know, people participating in self-care, their self-care is like, you know, something that could be considered indulgent. I don't know. Use your imagination.
Getting drunk?
Yeah. You know,
excessive consumption.
Excessive consumption, okay. Sure, is a great example. And then also these unrealistic ideals, like we said, of needing to have an entire day's worth of self-care for it to count. You know, whereas a lot of people don't have the capacity to go on a retreat for 6 days or what have you for their self-care practice, or go to an island for 2 weeks as part of their self-care practice. So I think we in the wellness industry have a responsibility to provide people with things that they can do that are healthy self-care practices that are accessible for real people working real jobs, taking care of real families, doing real things.
Not just the influencer who's right. probably got gobs of money inherited. And
I mean, maybe not. I'm sure that they have their own issues.
I'm sure they do too.
But just making sure that people feel empowered to take control of their self-care and participate in self-care rather than feeling disempowered, like, oh, I can't go on a meditation retreat, so I can't take care of myself.
Rob says, part of the problem with nutrition and supplements and vitamins is deciphering conflicting advice from doctors and specialists. How can you determine what is correct? Jill Chodak?
It's an excellent question. So I would refer you to a variety of resources. So registered dietitians are the go-to experts for nutrition. We study this at length. We're required to get a Bachelor of Science, and then many of us go on to get master's or PhDs.
And for those of you who have friends, it gets insufferable over the years. It's yes. really thorough. It's really
yes,
thorough.
Yes. We have to do a residency similar to those doctors, and it's all in nutrition. And so we are the go-to folks. And I realize I'm biased, obviously, because I am one, but we are really starting to be appreciated and utilized in the medical teams for our wealth of knowledge. It's what we do. The other places that you can go are the USDA.gov. It's like choosemyplate.gov. The governing body for all the dietitians across the country, it's eatright.org. And then each state has their own division of that. We try to keep certified dietitians across the country, we all practice science-based nutrition, so we're not pulling from anything other than facts and science. In our guidance, many of us, we don't make money based on your success or failure. We don't sell generally products. We just want you to get well. Kind of vetting your sources in that way will help to assess what type of information you're getting.
Let me squeeze in one more, and we got to keep it real tight. Cammy, about 30 seconds. Go ahead.
Okay. Hi, Nicole. It's Cammy from Breathe.
I wondered when I heard the name.
Okay. So so many things to speak to, but I guess I just thought about the self-care day that you reflected upon and how I thought it was very that you could speak to the fact that in today's busy busy world and fewer people being religious, more people being spiritual, and people noticing that they're so stressed out and something's missing from their lives, that perhaps a day on your weekend is akin to what the Sabbath was, when you wouldn't work, when you would be with your family. And I have a daughter-in-law who is Jewish and practices the Saturday Sabbath, and I mean, she turns off her phone. There are no electronics, and that is her road to wellness. And I just think it's about balance. Whatever works for anyone, that's perfect.
Cammie, thanks for that. I love that idea, especially when it comes to the impact of technology on our mental health. And I need that advice more than anybody. She directed it to you. You want to put a fine point on that as we get ready to close here?
Yeah, I think that's great. And I think that's part of the point, is it's really about doing what you can and what works for you, and not idealizing what someone tells you your self-care should look like, or your mindfulness practice, or your diet should look like, but really diving in and understanding from the inside out what wellness needs to look like for you, rather than it coming from outside sources.
Are you going to teach yoga again in the future?
Probably.
Okay. Semi-retired for now. Nicole Vandenberg, thank you for taking the time to be here.
Thank you.
Jill Chodak is a clinical dietitian with the Center for Community Health and Prevention at the University of Rochester Medical Center. They can find you there, I take it there.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you for being here. And Lou Guadagnino is the co-founder of Living Stress-Free, Inc. Where do you want people to find you, Lou?
You can find me either at livingstressfree.org, our website, or we just started a new podcast called the Living Stress-Free Podcast on iTunes.
You started a podcast?
Started a podcast.
You're competing with me.
You're
thanks
dust.
A lot, Lou.
You're dust, Evan.
Thanks a
you're
lot,
dust.
Man. I invite you on for an hour. Thanks for that. I want to thank all of our guests, because I think there's a lot of great stuff here, and I hope that nobody takes this conversation as saying wellness in general is a bad thing. It's a question of making sure that we're keeping in mind the reasons we're doing what we're doing, and we're trying to feel as good as we can without letting society tell us how we ought to be feeling about ourselves in many different ways. So great stuff from all of our guests. And of course, Don, thank you very much for volunteering. Rob Braden, the engineer, and Megan Mack, the producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a beautiful afternoon. Talk to you tomorrow on Member Supported Public Radio.